Thanks, Carlo. And good afternoon, everyone. Thanks for all the intros. As you heard, I'm joining you from the unceded territory of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh First Nations, otherwise known as Vancouver. Really happy to be with you. Happy that you all made time for this topic. Really happy to be doing this with John and Rebecca, who I have followed with admiration both of their work for many years. So glad to be doing this. As you heard, I'm going to be drawing mostly on my book, A Good War, some ideas from the book, Mobilizing Canada for the Climate Emergency, sharing some key lessons from that. And along the way, I also want to share some of the campaigns that we work on with the Climate Emergency Unit, particularly the ones that are most relevant to the topic of just transition and most relevant to those of you who are labor activists. So I'll try to keep my comments, as you heard, to 20 minutes or so, and looking forward to hearing from Rebecca and John and having lots of time for Q&A with all of you. And it's nice, it's a smallish group, so we can keep it casual and have lots of discussion. Just to say off the top, though, about the climate emergency itself and ground it in that, it strikes me that it wasn't that long ago, even at the time that I was writing my book in 2019, that when people, particularly in Canada, used to think about the climate emergency, if we thought about it at all, we tended to view it as a threat somewhere else, sometime in the future. But it sure doesn't feel like that anymore. I think the last few years have really been a time of our reckoning with the climate emergency. Here in the province where I live, British Columbia, we have had, frankly, just a devastating few years. Starting in 2021, where we had this extreme heat dome event that shattered temperature records and robbed us of over 600 of our fellow British Columbians in less than a week. I want to drive home that point. That June 2021 heat dome remains the most deadly weather event in Canadian history. Most of those who perished were isolated, lower-income seniors, and it was preventable. If their homes had already been unplugged from gas and converted to electric heat pump systems, which we urgently need to do to lower greenhouse gas emissions from buildings, but which also conveniently cool in the summer, it's very likely that all of those people would still be with us. But we've also experienced, devastating wildfires, atmospheric rivers. I mean, God, we didn't even know what that term meant a few years ago, but with incredible losses, incredible expense to people's homes and infrastructure. As Carlos mentioned off the top, we just keep breaking temperature records globally. Last year was the wildfires in Canada last year didn't just set new records, they exploded them. More land burned in 2023 in Canada than the territory of Greece, and emitted so much carbon dioxide that the emissions from last year's fires were about 3.5 times Canada's total annual domestic emissions from everything else. So this is the space in which we find ourselves. And increasingly, the emergency is coming for the people and places that we love, and claiming lives of the very people who are rallying in our defense. Last year also saw 8 firefighters die, including four in my province. And what you're going to hear from me is I'm a little, I've become everyone's weird uncle. I talk a lot about World War II, and I find myself thinking a lot about World War II. And I think about how in World War II, Canada was a population of about 11 million people. Over 1 million of them enlisted. 64% of them under the age of 21. And I find myself thinking, like, who are those young people today? And really, there are these young people like 19-year-old Devin Gale and 25-year-old Zach Muse, these young firefighters who died last year. These young people who are again rallying in our collective defense. this isn't just a Canadian story, of course. It's happening around the world. It's overwhelming at times. It's sometimes easier to look away. I think many of us are wrestling with these growing feelings of grief and anxiety as we witness all of this. And we're stuck where we seem to mobilize to put fires out, but not yet to prevent them. And all of this feels so dissonant, particularly at the political level, where I guess, you know, the opening question I put to people is, when you look at federal and provincial government responses, does anything about it look and sound and feel like an emergency response to you? And it sure doesn't look like that to me. And when we think about these events, I guess the point to drive home is that if we fail to act quickly, then over the course of the coming decades, things get very grim. A world that is unlivable and catastrophic for many, deeply uncomfortable and disruptive for all others, quite possibly ungovernable. So this is an ecological crisis, but, and I emphasize this point to you as labor activists and social justice activists, it is just as equally a human and social justice crisis and a civilizational threat. And that's the last of the scary news you're going to hear from me. Instead, I want to offer a bit of a solutions framework, drawing upon my book, which people find, ironically, unusually hopeful, notwithstanding the subject matter. So the original twist of my book, as the title suggests, is that it is entirely structured around lessons from the Second World War. It's great irony to that. I'm the child of Vietnam War resistors. That's why I happen to be Canadian. I cut my political teeth in the peace and disarmament movement in the 1980s. And if you had told any of my high school friends I'd written a war story, they'd be pretty surprised. But here I am, now strongly of the view that climate breakdown requires a new mindset to mobilize all of society and galvanize our politics and fundamentally remake our economy. And also finding inspiration from this story that when we actually treat emergencies as an emergency, they are transformative. They transform our social relations, our labor relations, our economy, our politics. Why do we need a new approach? So first of all, let me screen share an image with you. There. I think you're seeing it. These are Canada's greenhouse gas emissions going back the last 20 years. With a little hat tip to Greta Thunberg and her apt description of climate promises to date as so much blah, blah, blah. And just let this sink in. Like what I see when I look at this, you know, you see some ups and downs. It's basically a flat line. Our GHG emissions plateaued at an historic high. You know, emissions starting to come down a little bit in the last couple of years there. But fundamentally, we have failed to truly bend the curve at the pitch and pace that both science and justice demands. And we are not on a path to stave off a horrific future for our kids and future generations. We have run out the clock with distracting debates about incremental changes. And where it matters most, actual GHG emissions, we've accomplished precious little. And here we are staring down this harrowing gap between what the science says we urgently have to do and what our politics seems willing or able to entertain. And somehow we've got to kickstart something new. And for those of you who work in the labor movement, I think we're at this point where, with the transitions that are inevitably coming, to continue to tie the fate of workers to the fossil fuel industry is to consign them to a tumultuous, disruptive, and hopeless future. But it's also the case that part of what we have failed to do, I mean, when I look at the response of the federal and provincial governments, there has been no just transition offer. You know, part of what has plagued the ill-fated oil and gas emissions cap or anything is that even as the government starts to make moves on climate, they have yet to offer a hopeful and compelling counteroffer to working people and the communities that currently rely on fossil fuels. And in failing to do that, they have made it ripe to present climate policies as somehow elitist and doesn't give a crap about working people. And too much of that critique is true. And it's left us totally vulnerable to this populist right-wing backlash. I didn't actually start off planning to write a war story. My book began as an attempt to look at that. How do we align our politics and economy in Canada with what the science says we urgently need to do? In the original book outline, there was going to be a single chapter on the Second World War, because I thought, you know, for all of us who have this question in our mind, like, can we actually retool the whole economy in just a few years? I thought, you know, I'm going to dig into the World War II story, because we kind of did that. But then the more I dug into it, it started to explode my mind. Like, I'd been dealing with climate for many years at that point, but it was making me look at it all through a fresh lens. Like, oh, this is what it looks and sounds and feels like to actually be in emergency mode. And I started to see this, so many parallels between our wartime experience and the crisis we now face, and also this hopeful reminder that we've done this before. We've mobilized in common cause across class and race and gender to confront an existential threat. And in doing so, we actually retooled the entire economy twice. Once to ramp up military production, and again 6 years later to reconvert to a peacetime economy. And so, you know, I remember turning to my wife one night and saying, oh, you know what, actually, I think the whole book's about World War II, and let's explore that. But the question that comes up ever since the book came out 4 years ago, most frequently, is how do you know when a government actually gets the emergency, like when they're actually in emergency mode? And trying to distill the book down to answering that question, came up with this framework that I want to share with you now, of what my team and I call the six markers of emergency. So here they are. This is when you know that a government has shifted into emergency mode. And now, appreciate for a moment, these were written with an eye to senior levels of government, but really they apply just as much to a municipal level government, indigenous government, a union, a pension fund, a faith institution, a post-secondary institution. These are the markers of when you know that the leadership is actually in emergency mode. It commits to spend what it takes to win. It commits to create new economic institutions to get the job done. It shifts from voluntary and incentive-based policies to mandatory measures as needed. It commits to tell the truth about the severity of the crisis and communicates a sense of urgency about the measures that are necessary to combat it. It commits just as equally to leave no one behind, understanding that when you're actually trying to mobilize the society, it requires social solidarity. And inequality is toxic to social solidarity. And you need to make that commitment to those who feel economically and in their employment tied to the fossil fuel economy. You need to make a compelling counteroffer, like I mentioned before. And six, last but not least, you center Indigenous leadership rights and title. Now, we did the first five of these big time in World War II. I would actually say the federal government mostly hit these targets with some misses in the first year of the pandemic. But when it comes to climate, it's not just that the federal government doesn't hit all of these, or any provincial government, or of any political stripe. It's not that they don't hit all of them. It's that they failed to hit a single one of them. So in the time I have left, I just want to explore these markers in a little bit more detail and think about how they also apply to a union and the labor movement. So like when you think about marker number one, spend what it takes to win, moving into that emergency mentality that frees us from an austerity mindset. We kind of did that in the first year of the pandemic, right? We spent a lot on the CERB and the wage subsidy. So federal government spending, the debt to GDP ratio went from about 30% to 50% in a single year. It's a big jump in a single year. Still pales in comparison to the war. We ended World War II with the debt to GDP ratio more than double that. And in writing the book, I became quite fascinated with this guy, C.D. Howe, who oversaw all of Canada's military production. You know, no lefty. You know, he was on the right wing of Mackenzie King's cabinet. He'd made a lot of money in the private sector before going into politics. But he was kind of seized with this task. And when he was pressed about this extraordinary ramp up in military production and all of the money that was being spent, he famously replied, "If we lose the war, nothing will matter," which I think is sort of apt to the present. And in order to pay for all of that, brought in a host of new progressive taxes, including, by the way, a cap on profits. So the excess, the way the, because of the excess profits tax in the war, the kind of profiteering that we witnessed as a country in World War I, and again in the years through the pandemic and since the pandemic, you know, this obscene profiteering we've been witness to, that was illegal in the Second World War. So I think it sort of drives home the need to bring windfall profits tax and wealth taxes to this fight. Again, part of how you commit that when we say we're all in this together, we damn well better mean that we're all in this together. But spending on climate in Canada doesn't hold a candle to any of this. Like, for example, in that first year of the pandemic, federal government spending was about $6 billion a week. Federal spending on climate, generously, is about 15 or 16 billion a year. 15 billion a year versus 5 billion a week. One of them's emergency, the other one isn't. And then marker number two, and this is the one I want to spend the most time on in the time I have, creating the economic institutions needed to get the job done. You know, during this, the Second World War, starting from a base of virtually nothing, the Canadian economy and its labor force pumped out a volume of military equipment that is simply mind-blowing. In those 6 years, Canada, with a population about a quarter what it is today, produced 800,000 military vehicles, more than Germany, Italy, and Japan combined. 16,000 military aircraft, ultimately building the fourth largest air force in the world at the time. Here in my province, where we seem to be unable to build a single BC ferry anymore, we produced about 350 ships, again with from a base of virtually nothing. You know, the shipyards had all gone dormant in the Depression. We had to import naval architects from the US and the UK. We had to recruit and train up an entirely new workforce. The Vancouver Shipbuilders Union local went from a small local of 200 guys to the single largest local of men and women in the country. That's what it means to be an emergency. And you know, on the I see somebody here, a friend from the UAW on the call here. You know, I like to give the example on the automotive front. Think about the timing here. Pearl Harbor happens in December 1941. In February of 1942, 2 months later, the last civilian automobile rolls off the assembly line in Detroit, and for the next 4 years, their production and sale was basically illegal. It's remarkable what can happen in an emergency. And C.D. Howe, in order, you know, C.D. Howe was happy to give private sector contracts to his buddies, but he was in a hurry. And anytime the private sector couldn't quickly do something, he creates another crown corporation. In those war years, he creates 28 new crown enterprises to meet the supply and munitions requirements of the war effort. Justin Trudeau has created two crown corporations, near as I can tell, the Canada Infrastructure Bank, which has mostly done very little, and the other one, I hate to tell you, it's the Trans Mountain Pipeline Corporation. It's the one that makes us all the proud owners of a 60-year-old oil pipeline from Alberta through my province. If our government really saw the climate emergency as an emergency, it would, like C.D. Howe did, quickly conduct an inventory of all of our conversion needs and determine how many heat pumps and solar arrays and wind farms and electric buses we're going to need to virtually electrify everything and get off our reliance on fossil fuels. And then we'd see the establishment of a new generation of public corporations to ensure that those items were manufactured and deployed at the requisite scale. And I think labor could be leading the charge on the creation of some of those public enterprises. And your pension funds could be helping to finance them. But, you know, we need new municipal renewable energy utilities or public corporations to mass install electric heat pumps and rooftop solar and high-speed public rail and public building retrofit agencies and public agencies to mass build zero-carbon affordable housing. I mean, the possibilities are endless. And I had a little fun with this in the book. I tried to imagine, okay, by the same logic that we created all these crown enterprises in the war, what would those need to be today? And I have like a three-page listing of them. But part of why I fixate on the crowns is because when you're not creating new public enterprises, the best you can do is try to incentivize somebody else to build what needs to be built to do this, meet this task. And that's what the federal government's trying to do, right? They have this whole package of tax credits trying to entice the private sector to build what needs to be built. And it's mostly undersubscribed, those tax credits, because it's those interests that aren't even there. These are inherently public projects that we just need to lean into and do. And then I want to, in respect to that compelling counteroffer to workers, I want to mention two other public institutions, and then I'll leave the other markers be and let our other speakers go. But these are the two institutions I want to tell you about. The first is one that we call the Just Transition Transfer. I'll tell you about the one that doesn't have a lot of traction, and then I'll tell you about the one that does. One of the challenges we face in Canada is that while Canada as a whole is not terribly reliant on fossil fuels, parts of the country are, particularly Alberta, Saskatchewan, Northeast BC, Newfoundland. When I was writing the book, I did this interview with Gil McGowan, the president of the Alberta Federation of Labor. Gil's an interesting guy because he gets climate just as good or better than any labor leader I know. And there he is, president of the Alberta Federation of Labor, no less. But Gil was making the point that the rest of the country needs to appreciate that certain parts of the country have more heavy lifting to do. And he was musing, like, maybe that should be recognized in the equalization transfers from the Freds or something like that. And I was like, Gil, you don't want to do that because equalization's a mess and mostly works like it's supposed to. And what if instead we envisioned a new federal transfer, purpose-built for this task? We'll call it the Climate Emergency Just Transition Transfer. Make it big, $20, $25 billion a year. But then it would be different from other federal transfers for things like health and education in two important ways. Number one, unlike other transfers that divvy the money up by population, in this case, we would divvy the money up by greenhouse gas emissions. So Alberta is the source of 38% of Canada's greenhouse gas emissions, about four times their share of the population. We freeze that in time and we say, Alberta, you're going to get 38% of the money. That's a lot. But the second twist, we wouldn't send the money directly to these provincial governments because too many of them aren't to be trusted, especially that one. Instead, we'd create just transition agencies in every province to receive the money, jointly governed by all levels of government, Indigenous nations, put workers on the board, climate experts on the board, to then deploy that money on climate infrastructure projects and training programs that speak to the reality on the ground of the GHG profile of every province and the labor market and training needs of that place. We've been campaigning on that idea for a while, no take up from the feds, but that would be an example of a compelling counteroffer that would speak to those, I think, who currently feel reliant. The second idea I want to tell you about is the Youth Climate Corps. So I mentioned before how many young people rallied in World War II. And I had this hunch for a while that there were, again, tens of thousands of young people who wanted to enlist in this task of our lives. But finally, a year ago, I decided to commission a poll from Abacus Data to test that proposition. So in this national online poll, we gave them a short description, said, what if there was a two-year program, so not 4 months, 2 years, that said to everyone under the age of 35, if you want to sign up for 2 years, we have a place for you. Nobody will be turned away. And you could work in one of sort of three areas. Bucket one would be emergency response in the face of fires or floods or heat domes. Bucket two would be building community and ecological resilience in the face of climate change. And bucket three would be actually driving down our emissions with jobs and building retrofits or renewable energy or public transit and that kind of thing. So particularly around the building trades. And we tested this. And the Abacus results were super strong support across the board, across the country, across every demographic. Even a majority of conservatives thought it was a good idea. Now, then interestingly, and I want to show you this, in the second question, it only went to people under 35. And it asked them, if a program like this existed, how likely would you be to enroll for 2 years? And look at this. I'll show you. Basically, 65% of young people said I would be interested in enrolling. 15% said definitely. Now, there's about 9 million Canadians between 18 and 35. So this is 1.3 million Canadians saying, I get it. I understand it's an emergency. Sign me up. Where the hell is my invitation? Or even look at Alberta. 47% of young people in Alberta said they either definitely or probably would want to enlist in a two-year program like this. And look at that gender breakdown. I follow the climate polls a lot. This is the only climate poll I've ever seen where the enthusiasm among young men outstrips young women. The very demographic that is most being animated by the populist right now also says, I am highly interested in this. Maybe we should make them an offer to be their better selves. I've gone a little bit over. I haven't gotten to all of the markers. The main thing about marker three is we are stuck with governments that are trying to incentivize their way to victory with price signals and carbon taxes and tax credits and rebates. This is no way to fight the battle of our lives. And we need governments that are telling the truth. Maybe we'll talk about that in discussion. And that fundamental proposition around leaving no one behind, I've given you examples of how we can make that counter offer. But mostly, you know, there's some climate policy people who say, oh, don't link climate to all these inequality and social justice issues. Like, this is hard enough as it is. They're wrong. We need to link these things not only because they're linked. The richer you are, the higher your emissions, the poorer you are, the more vulnerable you are. We need to link these things because this is how we win. A successful mobilization requires that people make that common cause across class and race and gender, and that people have confidence that sacrifices are being made by the rich and not just the poor and middle classes. And that's what happened in the war, you know, with this famous Marsh Commission, and the introduction of unemployment happens in the war, and the family allowance in the war. Like, because when you're asking people to join in a grand undertaking, you have to offer an assurance that the society that's going to come out the other end is going to look more just and more fair than the one they're leaving behind. I'll stop there. Thanks.